it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. 2017 will be remembered in part as the year of the bear in South Central Alaska. We had a tragic mauling on the Chugach State Park Trail and another in the interior, both very rare black bear attacks. Far more bears were killed in Anchorage than usual, too. We'll have an expert to talk about the biology and the psychology of what happened. And for something a bit more fun, I'm also going to be chatting about cameras on today's show. If you're thinking about holiday gifts, maybe your outdoor person wants one. We'll find out how to choose something that works but won't slow you down. And to begin today's show, I have a couple of rock climbers in the studio. This sport is exploding in Alaska, indoors and outside on the ice. I'm looking forward to learning why it's fun and how you can learn to do it. That's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. In this segment, we're talking about rock climbing, ice climbing, a topic that I realize we really haven't touched on much, which is funny. I guess that's my fault for not thinking about it, because I tried it once, and boy, I wasn't very good at it. So it's not something I've done much of. So I really want to learn a lot about it today. And I've got two guests in the studio. Eric Wickenheiser is the operations manager of the Alaska Rock Gym. Thanks for being here, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
And Clint Helander is an alpinist, an ice climber, and just back from 7 weeks climbing in Nepal. And he's got lots of stories to tell about climbing. Thanks for being here, Clint.
Great to be here.
Well, I just wanted to start with why this is a sport that you guys enjoy. The one time I tried it, and I admit this is a long time ago, it felt like continuous pull-ups and just having my muscles just screaming at me. it's not an easy sport, right, Eric?
You know, I think it definitely can be as challenging as you make it.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people in the beginning make it harder than it needs to be.
Okay.
It's not nearly as much of an upper body sport as perceived by the outside community. A lot of technique goes into it, and when you see someone climb well, it looks effortless and efficient.
So it's one of those things, like, there's a lot of sports that the first time you try it, or maybe the first half dozen, it might not seem that much fun, like, you know, skiing or a lot of balance sports would be in that category. Mm-hmm. But then once you actually get it, then you say, oh.
Yeah, you definitely can find the flow state,
uh-huh,
similar to maybe even yoga or dance in some capacities.
And it seems like there's a real intellectual component to it as well.
Oh, I always joke that climbing is a sport for nerds, secretly. It's this extreme sport on the surface, but deep down there's a lot of math and science behind the gear and the equipment, the physics of the body mechanics and the movement and all of these things that, you know, there's more than one engineer out there that loves climbing, for sure.
So, yeah, yeah, so cool.
Yeah.
Well, Clint, it sounds like you've devoted a lot of your life to climb mountain climbing and rock climbing and ice climbing. I mean, what keeps you going back to it?
That is the age-old question in climbing. You know, why climb? And I guess I'm still looking for the answer, but really it's this connection to this completely wild nature, and at least in the world of ice climbing and alpinism, it's just this wild thing that really, there's nothing else quite like it.
Uh-huh.
It's a completely unique connection to this kind of ephemeral world in a place that very few people get to go to.
Hardly anybody's there, and you can only get there if you are able to accomplish something that's hard, right? I mean, it's like you're overcoming some challenges.
That's right, and to go back to what Eric was saying, in terms of climbing, I've always said that everybody struggles at their own level. So the brand new climber, all the way to the very best in the world, there is no mastering climbing. I mean, there is to a point, but everybody is always struggling if you're pushing yourself. So the hardest guys are still falling all the time.
Yeah.
And you are kind of always wrestling this giant, unholdable thing.
Yeah. Well, let's grab onto that falling thing just to begin with, because that sounds a little scary. There's a lot of safety preparations involved in successfully climbing, right? And in terms of, like, that fall is not a fall to your death, but it's just like, you know, get going again, right? And then, so talk about the safety ethic.
Yeah, that's right. In the media, there's the coverage is typically given to the Alex Honnolds and the people who free solo things, but that doesn't come without hundreds and thousands of hours spent on ropes, and really only less than 1% of people ever actually climb without a rope above any great height. And so that all begins at a place like the Rock Gym, or serving time under a mentor or experienced climber who quite literally teaches you the ropes, everything from tying in to learning how to belay, to learning how to trust the rope when you're top roping, descending. And then when you learn to lead climb, yes, taking falls if that's how you want to push it.
Yeah. So that must be really important, Eric, in the gym, because you're working with all ages and beginners and everybody else. I mean, how do you begin with that sort of safety ethic, and what are sort of some of the key things that you need to teach people about safety when they're learning to be a rock climber?
Well, we don't use the S word at the Alaska Rock Gym because climbing is dangerous. It's inherently dangerous. So it's all about risk mitigation.
Interesting.
Rather than, we never tell someone it's perfectly safe.
Right.
The gear is all bomber. We check everything regularly. There's a lot that goes into the mitigation of risk, like any industry, like the airline industry or anything like this. But when you leave the ground, it's inherently dangerous. And we just actively work every day at teaching people good techniques for belaying, trying to encourage people who've been climbing for a long time to continue to evaluate risk and make better choices, as well as bring in new people into the fold and try to explain what the risks are and how to, you know, reduce them to a bare minimum.
Interesting. Is risk in some way an attractive part of it? Let me throw this out to both of you. I mean, some people, I've got plenty of people in this studio who do crazy stuff, and they say, yeah, I want it to be dangerous because that's where I got my thrill. But I'm not necessarily sure that's true with rock climbing, because it seems a little bit more intellectual, a little bit less adrenaline. But let me throw that out to both of you guys as climbers. What do you think, Eric?
I think there's two sides to that. I think when a young man comes into the gym and he can choose the 40-foot wall or the 12-foot wall, even though the 12-foot wall might actually have a harder route up it, the appeal of being 40 feet in the air generally is more approachable to people. They get why that's worth doing. So I can't help but think that that perceived level of risk of being up there, even though the odds of anything happening are, you know, less likely than a car accident or something like that significantly, it's that perceived risk and that excitement that goes along with it.
Which is part of pushing yourself.
It is. It's a mental, and it is maybe intellectual in that sense, that it's a perceived risk that we have to push through mental boundaries to overcome.
How do you feel about that, Clint? Is a risk an added part of the experience, or something that you would be just happy if it wasn't there?
Oh, I'd be lying if I said that risk didn't play into it. And we as climbers certainly try to mitigate the risk, but if you get rid of risk in all forms, then yeah, that's really why climbing is different. So for me, when I'm out there ice climbing, which it's definitely much more dangerous than rock climbing, because you're climbing this ephemeral thing, you're putting screws into the ice, which the rule rock climbing is typically on a bolt or on a bomber piece of gear like a cam or a little piece of metal that you put in the rock, is that good protection is good. Ice climbing, the rule is don't fall. The leader must never fall.
Because you really don't know if that thing is going to hold.
Yeah, it's a hollow 16-centimeter screw put in ice that may be of dubious quality. And so all of a sudden you get a couple hundred pounds loaded onto it. I've taken one fall ice climbing, and that was about 13 years ago when I had just began. And I've taken hundreds of rock falls. So it's, yeah, it's definitely the mitigation of risk, to get back to the question. But
the risk is a good part of it.
Yeah, to a point. I mean, the beautiful part of climbing is mitigating that risk by making good choices and choosing who you go out with.
Yeah. Well, I want to learn a lot more about that. It's Outdoor Explorer. In this segment, we're talking about rock climbing, ice climbing, indoors, outdoors. Super popular sport in Anchorage, and growing all the time, in part because of the Alaska Rock Gym, of which Eric Wickenheiser is the operations manager. He's with us today. And Clint Helander is here, too. He's an alpinist and ice climber who does a lot of climbing all over the place. Eric, tell me, how does the gym relate to outdoor climbing? I mean, this is a place for people to go and learn, right?
Absolutely.
But it's also a place to tune up their skills. I mean, how does that, you know, is... Do people just climb in the gym and never go outdoors, or what? How does it relate to the indoor and the outdoor?
Well, I think it's important to note that climbing is growing at a rate that this country's never seen before.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's a brave new world out there. And you do have climbers who only have interest in climbing on plastic, as we put it, in the gym.
Uh-huh.
In a very controlled environment where the physical movement is the challenge. There's no objective danger of falling ice or rock, and it's a way to kind of distill out the movement, so to speak. And just
so a lot of the variables are removed, just down to the essence.
Down to the essence of the climbing movement and difficulty, absolutely. But that being said, I think it's a good place to learn how to belay and how to get the basic movement. It climbs very differently than, say, climbing outside. So a lot of times there is a difficult transition from someone who's only climbed in the gym and learned how to move on plastic, and then suddenly they're outside, and then it becomes much more of a puzzle of finding the path. It's less obvious.
Well, it seems like the holds in the gym, you know what you're going to be holding on to, and out on the rock wall, you don't necessarily know how good of a hold that is going to be or what it's going to be.
Absolutely. And even if you don't know exactly what that next hold is going to be like, you can see that it's bright orange and you know exactly where it is.
Right.
But outside, depending on the color of the rock, the lighting of the day, it can be very hard to see that next handhold or foothold. And you almost have to reach around and touch everything and decide that that's the best one.
Clint, do you spend time in the gym to tune up your skills, or how do you use the gym as an expert climber? You're not like learning the basics, right?
Well, whoa, let's be careful here and not call me an expert climber. A lot of people would contest that. but yeah, I certainly spend a lot of time at the gym, and especially in between seasons. It's great because there's kind of a mantra that says it's always 72 degrees in the rock gym. And so, you know, right now when the rock climbing outside is not so good, the gym is great. And it is a wonderful place to go in the middle of the day or right after work and see a bunch of people and not only have a great socializing experience, but also get to really work on your techniques and maybe just make plans for the weekend.
Yeah. So do you feel like you improve your skills in there, that there are certain things you can work on in terms of your rock climbing skills, or is it just more like, hey, let's go and have fun?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's certain times that I go in there and I do just want to have fun, but typically I go in there and while I'm having fun, I'm pushing myself, whether it's roping up and lead climbing and working a hard route that I haven't successfully climbed yet, or just saying that I want to work on my footwork this week, or crimping really small little holds, or working on big slab moves or something. So yeah, there's always ways to improve yourself, and plus it's got a great workout room, so uh-huh. I can go in there and throw some weights around.
Yeah, it's an amazing looking facility, Eric. I mean, how did this come about?
Well, the Alaska Rock Gym's actually been around for a long time in Anchorage. I believe we are one of the oldest indoor climbing facilities in North America.
Wow.
Number 11 or something like that. And August of 2016, August 1st, we opened the doors at the new facility, and it's just a natural progression along with the rest of the sport and the rest of the country where attendance was up. Literally, I never worked at the old facility, but I've heard stories about the pit and how crowded it was.
Uh-huh.
And it just seemed like a very obvious need to be filled, and a bunch of people came together. Some longtime owners, some new, and pooled their resources and put together this amazing new thing for the community of Anchorage.
Yeah, and it's quite, I mean, it must rank pretty well among facilities because it's really, really pretty big, right?
Yeah, it's large. It's not the biggest. Uh-huh. It's not the tallest. I argue it's one of the nicest.
Okay.
I think the design team did a really great job in looking at what was going on in the rest of the country, physically going to other world-class facilities in the lower 48 and trying to design something that, even though we're far removed, was on par with what the rest of the industry was doing.
Yeah.
And I think they succeeded.
So what are the favorite spots around here outdoors, Clint? I mean, like, I've often seen people climbing down on the Seward Highway, climbing those where those big icicles come down above the highway. What are some of the best places to work out outdoors in terms of vertical climbing?
Oh, that's the amazing thing about South Central Alaska in general is you can ice climb 365 days a year if you want. Not only is our winter period very long, but we have glaciers. And so the Matanuska Glacier is probably the first spot for many people. That was certainly the first spot that I climbed almost 14 years ago, but everywhere from Eagle River, there's many spots, all the way down to Homer, the Homer Bluffs. It gets these weird little oozes of ice on the sand cliffs. But yeah, there is no shortage. There are hundreds, thousands of individual drips that come in and are pretty well documented on websites and guidebooks around here.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like unless you were going with somebody who really knew their business, you'd want to make sure that this was a place that, that made sense to climb, because there's places where the rocks fall off and there's places, I mean, as you mentioned, the Homer Bluffs, if, wow, that seems like it would just collapse.
Yeah, and it certainly pays to have friends around who are giving you conditions updates, and not all ice climbs are always safe. So in Portage, for example, there are certain climbs that you do not go to anytime after it snows. But luckily, there's enough perfectly safe ice climbing that pretty much any day in the winter you can find something good to go.
What would be like? What would be the factor there? Like at Portage, where you mentioned an unsafe spot, what would be happening there that would make it unsafe?
Well, so the reason that these ice forms come in general is because they're fed by some kind of water source. And so you look at like a big concave bowl, and then as the sun hits that, or as water condenses, it goes down into the narrow hourglass portions of that concavity, and then when it gets cold, that freezes. And so those bowls also can collect snow, and it's pretty common to just drive down there and say, oh, it's either loaded, or you see little sloughs coming down, and that's one way to know it's not safe. And yeah, rock fall can be an issue as well. Uh-huh. But typically the rocks are pretty frozen in.
Yeah, interesting.
Anyone getting the Friends of the Chugach Avalanche emails today this morning? I read one that ice climbers, beware of Portage Valley. So The community's tuned into the fact that a lot of ice climbs are in avalanche terrain.
Yeah. This may seem like a dumb question, but it may be one that a lot of listeners would be curious about. If you are starting out as a climber and you want to do this, I think the fear would be like, what if I can't do it, right? What if I can't get to the top? What do I do then? And I suppose in the gym, it's pretty simple. You just climb back down again, right? I mean, tell me about how you deal with sort of beginners and their fears.
Hmm. Well, again, as Clint pointed out earlier, the great thing about climbing is we're all kind of experiencing the same fear, uncertainty, and doubt, regardless of the difficulty level. So there's plenty of climbs that the best climbers in the world are working on that they can't get to the top of. And they come right back to the ground and collect themselves and perhaps try again. So it's a common thread regardless of where you are on the spectrum. For beginners, it can be a bit more, you know, mentally and emotionally taxing to be defeated like that. But I also find, at least in the gym, a lot of people, they'll come up to you after the day and go, oh, I didn't get that one, but oh man, I'll be back. And people joke about thinking about colorful pieces of plastic in their off time and not being able to wait to come back and try it again. So I think for the climbing mentality, the person that really enjoys the sport, failure is not always a defeat. It's more of a motivator sometimes to come back and try harder.
I'm guessing, this is just my speculation, I'm thinking about other sports, but the younger you start, probably the easier it is to sort of pick up on the flow and sort of like just the fun of it, because as a kid, your center of gravity is low, you sort of have more strength for your body size, I think, and also just have that like, who cares? You don't really worry about things that much.
Yeah, we are learning that definitely it's like gymnastics, where there's kind of the young body excels. A lot of people think we all know how to climb, and we lose that as we go into adulthood and then have to relearn it. And with climbing becoming a competitive discipline in the Olympics and whatnot, all the best competitive climbers in the world tend to excel at a younger age and then move on to different disciplines within the sport as they get older.
Yeah, so, yeah, interesting. I didn't know it was in the Olympics. So is that kind of who can get to the top of this thing fastest? Is that how they do the competition, or how does it work?
It's actually rather involved. There's three disciplines. There's bouldering, sport, and speed. So bouldering is shorter, typically steeper and tougher routes with no ropes onto big pads. Sport would be with a rope, lead climbing, again, taller walls, anywhere from 40 to 60 feet, really challenging. And then speed where there's a set route that everyone in the world practices on, and then it's literally just who can get up at the fastest. Yeah. And the Olympic Committee is requiring you to excel at all three in order to compete.
I got you. Is that something you guys are developing at the and doing at the Rock Gym?
I think any gym in the country or perhaps even the world that's really trying to stay on the forefront of the sport, whether they like it or not, they have to accommodate the children, the young people coming in and really wanting to push themselves.
Yeah.
So we have a speed wall at the Alaska Rock Gym, and anyone who goes there between the hours of 3 and 6 on a weekday can attest to the number of children burning them off their projects.
The rocker. These little kids in the gym are amazing. I mean,
go during school hours, not when they're off.
Yeah, they'll make you feel bad.
It's incredible. These little 7-year-olds absolutely shame me on these boulder problems and even on the rope climbs. You know, I've been climbing for 14 years or something, and they get up there and just smoke me on these problems that I can't do. And I go, well, wait until you gain 100 pounds. But
yeah, that's right.
It's been really amazing now going there for a long time to see these some of these kids who probably started when they were 7 or 8 years old, and now they're in college and really transitioning into adulthood, and they're still just fantastic.
Yeah,
and so
because once you've got it,
boy,
right?
I wish I'd known about that 10 years before.
Yeah. Yeah, Outdoor Explorer, we're talking about rock climbing today with Eric Wickenheiser and Clint Hylander. And before we finish, I just wanted to get your advice on a listener who's thinking, wow, I'd like to try this. How do I get started? It looks scary, looks challenging, you know. And I think that our listeners probably Outdoor Explorer, you know. I live in Alaska, I want to do it outside. So maybe I'll start with you, Eric. I mean, because it seems obvious you'd want to maybe start indoors and then maybe transition outdoors. How do you go about starting? And what do you teach somebody who's just beginning from the, never done it before?
Yeah. I think generally most people will probably agree starting indoors is a little better. It's a little more of a controlled environment.
Uh-huh.
There probably are people out there who would be purists and want you to do it right from the get-go. But when you have a more controlled environment, the first thing everyone needs to learn is to how to belay, really. If you're going to do anything with a rope, you need to be a competent team member and hold the other end of the rope while your partner climbs.
And that's where you sort of have their life in your hands. If they fall, you're going to catch them.
Exactly, yeah. So for the gym, the entryway is essentially our what we call intro to gym climbing class, which is essentially a belay class where 2 hours you come in and we really try to get you up to speed, meet our standards and expectations as far as belaying, with a little bit of technical instruction as far as the climbing movement goes.
Yeah. Well, Clint, what would your advice be if somebody wants to try ice climbing, you know, getting outdoors in Alaska, climbing for the first time?
Yeah, definitely learning the ropes is really important. And second would be finding somebody competent and experienced with ice climbing outside. And the third part is even just acquiring the gear, because it's so much more for ice climbing that you need as opposed to just climbing in the gym. You have to have these big boots, these medieval-like looking tools, and crampons,
right.
You know, these really sharp things. And so
you could be on Game of Thrones after you like do this, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. You feel like you're climbing the wall or something.
Uh-huh.
But really, you just have to quite literally relearn how to walk in these spiky things.
Oh, wow.
And then, just trusting it and having someone that knows how to go out there.
Yeah, all that stuff must be really expensive.
Yeah, and so you can rent those things at Alaska Mountaineering and Hiking, for example. They have pretty much all the gear, so if you want to go try it out, there's so many good resources here in Anchorage, including the Mountaineering Club of Alaska has an annual ice climbing event at the Matanuska Glacier, and there's hundreds of people that show up. They're brand new. They've never climbed. And then AlaskaIceClimbing.com. There's a forum there and kind of an online guide, and you can find partners there. And then really just the Rock Gym. I mean, go there, go climbing and meet people, talk to people. I guarantee you right now on any given night, there's 25 or 30 ice climbers lurking around pulling on plastic.
Absolutely. So tell me about what are your personal goals as climbers? I mean, what would you like to accomplish that you haven't done yet, or what's next on your list? Do you think of it that way?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eric?
I definitely moved to Alaska to do the kinds of things that Clint, for example, has done. I'm very intrigued by alpine climbing and ice climbing, traditional climbing on rock with natural protection and whatnot. And Alaska is the ultimate playground, in my opinion, as far as the big, wild, untamed adventures go.
Yeah.
So for me personally, while the physical challenge of, say, sport climbing or indoor rock climbing are really fun, what drives me is big mountains and wild adventure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Going places where hardly anyone has been or maybe no one, and being a real adventure, right?
Absolutely. And I'm definitely, you know, way further down on the spectrum from Clint. I went to the Alaska Range for my first time this year, and it was a very overwhelming but positive experience.
Uh-huh.
My eyes have been opened a little bit. So I have a lot of smaller objectives to work on to be able to tackle those bigger things again.
But you've got a lot of skill. You got a lot of base of skill and physique, I'm sure, to do it that would put you in pretty good position, I would think.
I think the climbing fitness you get from a climbing gym, whether you're an indoor climber or an outdoor climber, everyone agrees that it's probably the easiest way to get that base level fitness you need for outside climbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Clint? You said you've just been in Nepal. It sounds like you've got probably a list of things you want to accomplish.
Yeah, I've been climbing in Alaska for 14 years and going into the Alaska Range on average 2 to 3 times a year for the last, 11. And so this time of the year is great because we start planning our objectives for the spring.
Yeah.
So this year I'm planning.
When the sun comes back.
Yeah, and the temps warm up a little bit. Right now I'm just really focused on ice climbing and skiing, but this spring we're planning on doing some first ascents in the remote St. Elias Range, and I'll go back to a part of the Alaska Range at the southwest corner called the Revelation Mountains and try a peak that I've tried 4 times. Hopefully this is the last time I have to go there, but I don't know. I'm still decompressing from Nepal. I haven't really given too much thought to going back to the mountains yet. So
it sounds like a great life, and you've really got to focus on what you enjoy doing and doing it. So awesome. Well, thanks a lot for coming in, guys. I'm really intrigued. I don't know if I will ever be much of a climber, but it sounds like a lot of fun, and I bet a lot of our listeners would like to try it. Eric Wickenheiser from the Operations Manager Alaska Rock Gym, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Clint Helander is an alpinist and an ice climber, and sounds like he's climbed a lot of Alaska and probably will climb a lot more. Thanks for being here, Clint.
Thank you, Charles. It's a pleasure.
All right. Please stay with us. Outdoor Explorer will continue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. And with me right now is a photographer who we've had on the show before. Dan Bailey's been at it for more than 2 decades. taking action in outdoor photography. He's got a book called Outdoor Action Adventure Photography, which you can find in town, probably like at Stewart's Photo or the Trek store. And Dan knows how to take pictures in a lot of outdoor situations. So my thought was, with the holidays approaching, what do you need to think about in terms of equipment? If you have an outdoor person on your shopping list and you thought, well, I'd like to buy, you know, a camera or some photo equipment to support what this person wants to do, what do I need? Well, it's pretty different depending on what they're going to shoot, right, Dan? I mean, it's not like one size fits all for the most part.
Yeah, there's a lot of different cameras out there, and you know, the technology of the camera can vary wildly. And so, for example, if you're an action shooter, you probably want something that has a lot more features and fast autofocus. But if you shoot landscapes and things that don't move quickly, then your needs are going to be different.
Right, right. And also there's the issue of the size of the camera and its kind of ability to withstand you taking it outdoors, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you're shooting in tough environments and snow and rain and cold, you probably want something that's a little more rugged and weather sealed. And you mentioned size and weight, and that's a huge thing, especially for me. Cameras have gotten a lot smaller, some cameras have gotten a lot smaller. And so that's definitely a concern, because if you're having to carry, you know, if you're hiking or backpacking with your camera, you don't want to be burdened down with too many extra pounds.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I've read in looking into this recently is that a few years ago, we used to talk about megapixels, like how many dots were on the thing that is receiving the light energy and turning it into electrical energy for the chip. And sort of the bigger number, the better. But now they've sort of all gotten to a high enough number that you don't really have to worry about that so much anymore. And it's more about the glass, right? I mean, in terms of just going for a high-quality camera. True?
Yeah, that is true. You know, we won the megapixel war and the sensor war. And the reality is that that every single camera on the market is going to take great pictures. And so a lot of people are concerned primarily with sensor size and megapixels, and that's just, that's not where you should be concerned. You're right, glass, the lenses have a lot to do with it. But again, even today's lenses are so good. They're far superior to what they, you know, used to be. And so when I advise people on what camera to buy, ultimately I think it has to come down to, like we talked about, is it weather sealed? Is it going to withstand the elements? Is it going to do what I need it to do? But most important thing is, how does it feel in my hands? You know, it's like a musical instrument. Is this the guitar that makes you want to play it? Is this the camera that makes you want to pick it up and go out and play with it and use it?
Now, what most of us have some kind of phone in our pocket that has a camera, and the newer iPhones, at least, and probably the other brands too, have really good cameras. I mean, you can take a terrific picture, but with a set focal length. So, in other words, they're always kind of broad. The object needs to be pretty close. If you take a picture of a mountain or an animal with one of those things, you get a little teeny weeny speck. What are the reasons why you would want to upgrade from just taking your phone along?
Well, that's like you just said. If you want to take pictures of wildlife, you know, if you're in the Denali Park bus or if you're backpacking and you see moose or bears off in the distance, your iPhone is not going to do a very good job.
Yeah.
And so the issue is it becomes about trade-offs. Obviously, the phone is incredibly convenient. It's in your pocket all the time. And there's a saying that goes, the best camera is the one you have with you.
Right.
So there are a lot of times where I and a lot of other photographers will whip the phone out and take a picture because you're trying to capture a scene that's right in front of you and the moment. But yeah, if you want the versatility, the flexibility, the technical capabilities, then you need to.
And like in this action photography, you need to be able to zoom in on the person you're shooting. And what are some of the technical characteristics you want to look for if you want to take pictures of like people skiing or people, you know, snowboarding or riding?
Having a decent zoom or a lens is going to be a key thing, you know. And you know, that kind of breaks it into, do you want an interchangeable lens camera or a point-and-shoot style camera? And, you know, if you want the best quality and the best performance, an interchangeable lens camera is going to do the trick. And sadly, the phones, or just the way it's played out, phones have kind of killed or diminished the number of point-and-shoots that are available.
Right, because they do a lot of what a point-and-shoot does. So an interchangeable lens camera is sort of like what we used to call an SLR. It's sort of a significant size that you can screw lenses onto, right? And some of those lenses are large and heavy.
Right, and it's a single lens reflex was the traditional camera. Now there's another class of cameras that called mirrorless cameras. And essentially, they've taken away the mirror and the pentaprism, which reduces size and weight. And they've made use of the modern technology, you know, with LCD screens. And so mirrorless cameras are actually very capable cameras. And I used to be an SLR shooter for years, but I'm a full-time pro and I've switched full-time to mirrorless cameras. And so in my mind, mirrorless cameras are the way of the future, and they're smaller and lighter. And I would advise anybody who's looking for a new camera to look mirrorless first.
If you're interested in landscape or close-ups of plants and or maybe just a group and not worried about like somebody skiing by really fast, will a point-and-shoot still do the job, or do you really still want to have a camera with separate lenses?
You know, it comes down to convenience, and you know, there's something to be said for going out with one length, one camera, you know, one focal length, and just getting what you get. Obviously, if you want more lenses, different viewpoints, different capabilities, and faster autofocus, then a mirrorless.
Sort of how important are the pictures to you in this picture? Yeah.
Exactly. What do you want to do with your camera?
What are some of your favorite accessories? Oh, I like. Well, this is getting pretty complicated. I'm not going to buy my girlfriend a camera, but maybe I could get her a waterproof case.
Yeah, in my mind, the number one thing would be a camera pack or a camera bag.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of cases and bags out there and backpacks that allow you to, like, say you're going to go hiking, you want to carry your camera and you want to carry, you know, some clothes and water and snacks. And there's a lot of new bags out there that have a separate compartment for the camera, so you don't have to dig around inside
right.
your main compartment to find it and have easy accessibility.
Uh-huh.
Straps are another thing.
Tripod or monopod?
Yeah, tripod's a really good accessory. You know, even a small tabletop tripod know, when I travel, I do bike tours a lot, and I take a little tiny GorillaPod, which is a brand of a small, yeah. a small tripod, and it's small, it's tiny, and it's not nearly as stable as a big heavy tripod, but you know, and it'll get by in a pinch.
It's portable, and it'll do yeah. the job. Yeah, because a lot of times you're just trying to balance your camera on a log or something, and it gets very frustrating.
Yeah,
yeah. Cool. Well, I mean, there's a lot of options, and but where do you shop online? Do you shop locally? I mean, what's the best way to buy a camera, in your opinion?
The best way to buy a camera is to go to a store and look at them.
And touch it.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, and touch it. Because like I said, the best camera is going to be the one that feels the good in your hands, that you,
yeah.
it's easy to control the
And then you support your local merchant. Yeah.
And absolutely. And we're very lucky in Anchorage to have Stewart's Photo. They're right downtown. Yeah. And they have an amazing selection of gear. They have anything that you would never need to buy. And they have decent prices too.
All right. Well, quite the advertisement for Stewart's Photo. And your book is there too. It's Outdoor Action Adventure Photography. Dan Bailey's a photographer. Thanks a lot for being in, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Charles.
Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. This last year was a very unusual one for human interactions with bears in the Anchorage area, and indeed in other areas of Alaska, as we had some tragedies that were just really terrible. There was the Bird Ridge Run, which led to the death of a young man, and then there was a woman who was killed in the interior, and very surprisingly by black bears. It's so unusual for them to be dangerous in that way, and for two deaths in short order was very unusual and really caught the attention of the public. Through the course of the summer, there were also a lot of bears put down here in Anchorage in defense of life and property. So what is going on, if anything, or is it just an anomaly? And it's a topic that has to do with biology and with psychology, because, of course, it's our interaction with bears. There's two sides to this equation. So for that discussion, I've got a couple of experts in the studio. Dave Battle is area biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's the guy who manages the people and the animals here at Anchorage. Thanks for being here, Dave.
Well, thanks for having me.
And Elizabeth Manning is an education outreach specialist. She's a bit on the human side of trying to get the humans to be wrangled and to be dealing with bears in the best possible way and reducing problems and just through education and awareness. Thanks for being here, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Dave, maybe we could just start by putting some numbers to this. It sounds like this was an unusual last year, 2017, in terms of the number of incidents that took place and the number that led to bears actually being killed either by fish and game or by property owners.
Yeah, it was very, very high number of bears, both by agency kills and by Defense of Life and Property, DLPs, we call them. Like several times higher than last year. That last year was a bit of a low number. It was kind of a low year. And we have fluctuations like that every so often, year to year. And it's kind of hard to put, it's kind of hard to say exactly what causes. There's a lot of factors that go into these things, but some years we might have more bears in town. Anecdotally speaking, it seemed like we had more bears in town this year. A lot of years we have a couple of hot spots that are generating a lot of calls, but other spots in town might be pretty dead as far as bear calls go. This year seemed like all of our hot spots were hot, you know, the places that we've seen bears in the past, and multiple bears in some of them. I don't think that was a population explosion or anything like that. Bears just don't tend to reproduce that fast to where you would go from a very low number last year to a very high number this year. I think it's more likely a distribution distribution on the landscape, maybe due to food supplies or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, what about just, there's another half of this equation, right, is the human beings. And are they, if they're more attuned or more worried about it, is there more likely to be a sort of a conflict or an issue because they're read something in the newspaper or seen something on TV?
Certainly. And you have to throw social media into that, too.
Right.
A lot of bear issues made the media this year, and social media, and these days everybody can post on Facebook and on their Nextdoor app and that sort of thing, so it just heightens people's awareness, and it might very well lead, we don't know for sure, but that might very well lead to more defensive life and property killings.
Just because people are more aware, or maybe they're more on edge.
And they might be more afraid of it, you know, with the fatalities that you mentioned. We did have quite a few incidents after that. And it could be that some people who normally might have been fairly tolerant, particularly of black bears in their neighborhood, suddenly they realized, hey, these are wild animals, and they became much more defensive about it.
Right. So I led off by talking about how fatalities from black bear attacks are very rare. Mm-hmm. And I certainly run into a lot of black bears all summer, and they almost always run away. Or yep. Actually, they've always run away.
Yep.
I mean, that's true, right? I mean, the black bears generally are not the bears we worry about. We worry more about brown bears and certainly polar bears.
Absolutely. I always, when I'm talking to people about these things, I always have to caveat it and say that black bears are still wild animals. You have to be cautious about them. But typically, yes, we don't worry nearly as much about black bears. They almost always are not aggressive. We are more tolerant of them in these conflict situations than we are of brown bears. For one of the primary reasons is that black bears, it's very, very rare for black bears to defend food sources from humans. They might act a little defensive, they might slap the ground or pop their jaws, but it is so rare for them to make contact for that reason that it's, you know, it's just, I keep saying, using the word rare, but that's the word
it's
to
use.
It's
almost unheard of.
It's almost unheard of. They also very, very rarely defend cubs from humans. Once again, they send their cubs up a tree. They sit, you know, the mm-hmm. sow will sit at the base of the tree and slap the ground or pop her jaws or something, but it's very rare for to actually attack someone for that reason. Brown bears are very well known for defending both food sources and cubs from humans. So we more often have to take action when brown bears are involved in these situations. But with black bears, we really try to go more towards education and enforcement whenever we have to, whenever we issue citations or get the troopers to issue citations.
But most of these black bears that were killed this summer in defense of life and property, most of these bears were black bears, mm-hmm. you know? And so, I mean, we could kind of guess that like nobody was going to get hurt by them, but maybe they're becoming too accustomed to human food, or were those shootings mostly justified, do you think?
Well, it's kind of, you know, you have kind of a whole continuum there when you're talking about justification. It's kind of hard to say. Sometimes we don't know the whole story. The state
There's
law.
Only one person there, maybe.
Yeah, there might have only been one person there, and we don't know what was going on before we got there, or what their neighbor has been doing. It could, you know, a lot of times bears that start getting into trash and getting into these human attractants, they might be visiting the neighbor's trash, and they start visiting various houses in the area. They figure out that sometimes trash is kept outside next to houses, and they might start checking out all the houses, and sometimes that leads the neighbors into a DLP situation because it might not have been their trash, but if their neighbor is being trashy, then it just it causes problems for the whole neighborhood.
It accelerates, yeah. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Manning, your job is in education, dealing with the public. Did you find a higher level of concern about bear encounters this year than you have in other years?
Oh, for sure. You know, every year, every few years, or every so often, we do sometimes have a bad year mm-hmm. with high conflict. This year was particularly bad, and there was certainly a lot of increased anxiety among members of the public who came to our regular programs that were already set up, and we did set up and have some additional programs to help out residents who were feeling concerned or not sure what to do if they were to encounter a bear or how to properly deal with their attractants.
Yeah, and as Dave was saying, that there people are picking this up from the media and from social media, and it's not necessarily that they've had a bad bear encounter, but they're afraid they might.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're hearing that their neighbors have seen bears, or they're mm-hmm. hearing that bears are getting into garbage in their neighborhood or another neighborhood, and they definitely express concerns.
So what kind of, what are your main take-home messages that you are delivering to the public on this subject? I mean, I'm thinking that there's probably, and you correct me if I'm wrong, there's two different audiences. One would be our outdoor person who is actually spending a lot of time in the backcountry and probably knows if they're at all prepared, they kind of know how to deal with bears. And then somebody lives in Anchorage and maybe is not so outdoorsy and also is running into bears.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that because we had a bad year in 2008. And after that happened, we formed a group called the Anchorage Bear Committee Education Group of a bunch of different educators from different agencies. And we realized that we needed to do a better job to educate Anchorage residents about how to handle bear encounters and what to do with bears. And people sort of assumed that they knew what to do, and a lot of people do, but it's always good to get a refresher every year. But we do sort of have two different main sets of messages. We have, you know, how do you deal with attractants around your home? How do you make sure that you're not attracting bears to your home or neighborhood? How do you be a responsible homeowner? And then secondly, and that also applies to camping, how do you deal with your attractants when you're camping or backpacking? And then secondly, you know, how do you recreate responsibly in bear country? How do you make sure that you can avoid bears by making noise, being in a group? And then how do you respond if you do have a bear encounter? And it's not like there's a set, you know, if A happens, then you must do B and C will happen. It's not that simple.
Right.
But there are some sort of best practices that bear biologists have come up with over time.
Right.
So we've worked to distill those messages in a clear and understandable way for the public as best
and
as possible.
And obviously avoidance is number one, and avoidance is not really all that hard in terms of, a lot of it's just hygiene and, you know, keeping your garbage inside. And if you're camping, you know, using a bear-proof container or whatever method you're going to use to keep your food contained away from the tent and all that stuff. But what people really focus on was more like, what am I going to do if I'm actually attacked, right? And then there's a discussion about mm-hmm. weapons and what weapon to choose. And I guess you have a program to actually show people how to use their bear spray so that they shoot the bear instead of shooting themselves and that kind of thing.
Yeah, several years ago, we started really stepping up our bear spray training. It had been really effective in other states. So, and it's not that at Fish and Game we don't advocate bear spray over firearms, but for most people, bear spray is easier to use, easier to carry. They don't have to be real adept at using a firearm, for example, if they can just, it's easy to use and easy to, for most people to carry. So we mm-hmm. teach them how to use it properly. We use inert bear spray, non-active bear spray that people can train with.
I see. I've always, you know, you buy the thing and it costs $45 or $50. You don't want to practice with it because then you got to buy another one, right? So,
yeah, a lot of people have never taken the safety off. And that mm-hmm. alone, I mean, it's not mm-hmm. difficult, but unless you realize that you've got to get your thumb behind the little curved tab instead of just pulling on it, you could mm-hmm. be in a frustrating situation.
Yeah. Well, and if you're panicked by that kind of situation, mm-hmm. your behavior is not going to be predictable, right?
Right.
Have you been in that sort of situation, Dave, as a biologist, or you're?
Well, I've sprayed a lot of bears out of dumpsters, you know, stuff like that, you know, in various wildlife conflict situations. But I haven't had to really stop a charge. Not that I recall. I mean, a lot of these bear situations that kind of they start to run together after years of doing
I'm
it.
Sure.
I've used bear spray on a number of bears.
I just have to say that, you know, at my cabin down in Ketchumack Bay, we have lots and lots of black bears. Mm-hmm. And you get maybe a little casual about them, and usually shouting, just raising or waving your arms will make them go away. And I've also just used an air horn, or I've used my shotgun just to make noise.
Mm-hmm.
And generally don't get close enough to them to use a bear spray. Mm-hmm. The other thing I've observed is that bear spray doesn't last forever. You know, so it's an investment you've got to keep making, and probably multiple people in your party need it. Just mm-hmm. having one isn't going to be good. So mm-hmm. all this sort of adds up after mm-hmm. a while, right?
Right.
Yeah. So what do you think is the most important thing we could do in next summer to avoid a summer like this, Dave? I mean, if listeners are thinking, wow, I don't want to see all these bears getting shot, what can we be doing to make this better?
Secure trash. I mean, that is the number one thing. I mean, secure any attractants around your home. Bird seed is another big one, and smokers sometimes, but really the big thing is securing trash. If we could wave a magic wand and just have all the trash in the city secured, there would be no reason really for bears to come up around homes. We're always going to have bears. There's a lot of bear habitat running all through Anchorage and all around us, you know, the park and the basin, but there's these green belts and there's a lot of woods through a lot of areas of town. So we have a lot of bear habitat, and we know they eat a lot of natural foods in these places, and that brings them into closer proximity to people. So we can't really just get rid of all the bears in the city. So bears are driven by their stomachs. If they do everything, they don't really do anything unless they're getting calories out of it. So if a bear is coming around homes and particularly sniffing around homes, I can almost guarantee that it has gotten into trash around homes. So if people can just secure their trash, even if a bear had gotten into trash in a neighborhood before, if all the trash is secured now and the bear comes back a couple of times and it's not getting fed, it's not actually getting some calories, then that drops off its route. Everything is kind of a cost-benefit analysis to them, and they go where they can get the calories.
I wonder if people are aware that, you know, if they're careless with their trash, they're killing bears, you know, that there's a connection there, one to the mm-hmm. other. Because it seems like I would think most people wouldn't want to cause this problem.
I think most people wouldn't. There is a contingent of people who just don't think they should have to secure their trash, and they just think the bear should go away. So, I mean, that's kind of a very minority, I think, mm-hmm. of the people. But there are some of those. But I think there are a lot more people that are just kind of complacent. They haven't had a problem yet. And we have seen a lot of even when we have bears coming into a certain neighborhood and we know that bears are coming into the neighborhood and most people in the area know that the bear hasn't hit their trash yet, they think, oh well, you know, they just don't do anything about it. And that's one thing I try to tell people. If you're living in an area where there are bears and you're still keeping your trash out unsecured, you're part of the problem. Whether a bear has hit your trash yet or not.
Right.
It's going to happen eventually, yeah. You know, because we hear that so often. Well, I've just never had a problem with it. Well, you do now.
Right.
We do have a lot of people, though, get quite upset. They come into the office and they mm-hmm. want to pick up these door hangers that we have that we can put out on doors that say, you know, please secure your attractants, pick up bird seed, all that,
mm-hmm.
Because they're frustrated. They're doing the right thing, but their neighbors are not.
It's kind of like mm-hmm. one of those vaccine things. Everybody has to do it.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, you know, Dave will hand out quite a few of those mm-hmm. to homeowners yeah. throughout the summer, and we'll go put them out too.
Mm-hmm. It's Outdoor Explorer talking about bears today, about this last summer we had there where bears were all anybody was talking about. Elizabeth Manning and Dave Battle are from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. My name is Charles Wolforth. I had an encounter on the single track trail out at Kincaid Park this fall where I was riding along and there was a black bear and a cub. You know, you come around a corner, it's really not that far away from you. So I stopped, started to back away, and then a cyclist was coming the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm yelling, hey, there's a bear. And they're saying, what? What? And so pretty soon you realize something has changed here, is that we're actually using a lot more of these woods, this habitat you're talking about, mm-hmm. in a lot more different ways. And so maybe one reason for more encounters is just the bears can't get away from us, right? We're kind of everywhere. Do you think that's true, Dave, that there's a little bit more of people are everywhere too?
Absolutely. And that's something that I've seen just since I've lived in Anchorage since 99. It's become the trailheads have become much more crowded, and the trails that so yeah, the more people that are in the woods, the more encounters there are going to be.
Mm-hmm. And the bear habitat, as you said, in the bowl is pretty good for bears,
mm-hmm.
so they're not probably going to leave. They're happy being here.
Correct. They're yeah. they're getting all their needs met in those areas, and encounters with humans are probably still relatively rare for them. It's not like a human is chasing them out of their preferred area every day, you know, so they're still getting their food and their cover and all that sort of thing, and it's worthwhile to them to be there.
Do they cover a lot of ground? I've noticed that some of the moose kind of stay in the same neighborhood or the same area of a park for a long time period, and I'm wondering if the black bears roam around the city, or do they usually have a sort of a home area that they like to stick with?
Well, all animals tend to have a home range. And it depends on the gender of the bear and the age class, you know, whether it's a young bear that's dispersing and trying to find a new territory. So they're, you know, at certain times they might disperse out further away. But for the most part, you know, all animals will have a certain home range, and it differs per species. You know, black mm-hmm. bears probably roam a little bit further than moose do sometimes.
But. Right. And then not that many brown bear in the Anchorage Bowl, but there are some, right? I mean, they come down to the kind of Campbell Creek area.
We do have brown bears in Anchorage. We don't have as many. I mean, there are always more black bears around than brown bears, but we do have a number, and they actually move all the way through the green belts, and we've had them as far over as Kincaid Park. The brown bears that come into town tend to be what we would term as good bears. You know, in that. We don't have a lot of them getting into trash. Every so often we do have them get into trash, but a lot of the brown bears that actually do come into town are older animals, and they've learned to just stay away from us, you know, move mm-hmm. at night and not get into trash, and they just kind of keep to themselves. And a lot of times people just don't even know they're around.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, isn't it? I love the good bears and bad bears. It sounds like something out of Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
So do you feel like this, the number of bears that were put down this last year, plus the hunting that took place in the area, will have significantly reduced the population, so we would tend to maybe not see as many next year, or do we really have that information?
We don't really have that information. I mean, we certainly... between all those put together, hunting and DLPs and agency kills, we killed more bears. The hunting harvest was not exceptional. I mean, mm-hmm. it was a good harvest, but we've had higher hunting harvests and haven't seen any sort of reduction in population or anything that we could point to, really. The harvest for the next year didn't go down, and road kills didn't go down, and stuff like that. So I think the main thing is the DLPs and agency kills, but it's kind of hard to say whether we'll see fewer conflicts next year or more. It'll, you know, these things fluctuate year to year.
It sounds like, Elizabeth, you kind of have your work cut out for you in terms of getting people, you know, aware, and in a situation where there's more potential for conflict because we're using more areas. I'm not sure if Fish and Game has any policy about whether we should have more of these single track trails or I mean, is that something that you guys have weighed in on or something, or just?
It is something that we weigh in on. Uh-huh. We try to put in comments on projects, and it's a case by case basis. It's not a we have a policy of, you know, we don't oppose single tracks. We don't, you know, the main place that we feel compelled to put in comments is when we see single tracks going in areas where there might be large concentrations of wildlife, around a salmon stream,
like where the Campbell Creek area up by
exactly
Centennial
where there's
Park.
Right mm-hmm. where there's a lot of brown bears congregating into salmon stream seasonally. Single tracks are not really what we want to see go in there, because you're moving fast, and usually there's very limited sight lines, and mm-hmm. you come around a corner and.
That's why it's so much fun.
Yeah, exactly. it's fun until you run into into a big critter. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we can make comments, but once something happens, we do have to respond. So then we try to work with the user groups. Yeah. We've done a lot of education with some of the single track groups and mm-hmm. some of the kids biking groups, for example.
And as we finish up here, Elizabeth, tell people how they can learn more if they want to learn more about being safe around bears and how attracting
sure.
them.
Sure. I mean, probably the best thing in the winter is to go to our website, www.alaskabears.alaska.gov, and there's a whole bunch of information on there. We just finished a bear curriculum. And then also, we schedule bear talks, bear and moose safety talks in mm-hmm. classrooms. So okay. each year we
so somebody could invite you in.
Mm-hmm. So if you are a parent or a teacher or school, if you get on our website and look for that, you can go ahead and email me, and we can schedule talks. We're scheduling for the spring from April 10th through May 15th, I believe.
Great. Well, we will have those links on outdoorexplorer.org. And I want to thank both of my guests, Dave Battle, area biologist, and Elizabeth Manning, education outreach specialist from Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That's all for today's show. Thanks to my guests in our first segment, climbers Eric Wickenheiser and Clint Helander. Then in the next segment, we heard from photographer Dan Bailey. And then finally, you just heard from our bear experts. Don't forget, you can hear any of our content again or whenever you want at outdoorexplorer.org or on our podcast. Our producer is Eric Bork. Hannah Duro is our assistant producer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.